From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is it, they say. This could be, should be, the year the U.S. economy finally finds liftoff. Not a moonshot, nothing intergalactic, but good, solid growth for the first time since the Great Recession. This hour, On Point, we'll look at the why and how of that expectation and at what an economic takeoff now means for whom. We're looking at the economy 2014. Here's the closing bell from 2013. The stock market, for one indicator, has been off the charts. But who knows where that goes and what it means for the whole economy. Joining me now from New York is Heidi Moore, U.S. Finance and Economics Editor for The Guardian, former Wall Street correspondent for American Public Media's Marketplace. Heidi Moore, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
And from Westchester, Pennsylvania, we're joined by Mark Zandi, chief economist from Moody's Analytics. Mark, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
Big picture, what are we looking at, Mark? 2014.
It should be a good year. Economists use GDP growth as their benchmark. GDP is the value of all the things that we produce. That's been growing about 2% per year since the recovery began. The recovery is now 4.5 years old. In 2014, I expect GDP to accelerate to 3%, and then in 2015, 4% growth. So much better conditions dead ahead.
If we get 3 and 4% growth, these are numbers. What would it feel like? What would it mean? What difference would it make in what we look around and see going on in people's lives, Mark?
Well, I think it'll feel a lot better. Most people focus on jobs. So just to give you a sense of that, we've been creating a couple million jobs per year for the last 4 years. I expect about 2.5 million jobs in 2014 and 3 million in 2015. And so that means lower unemployment. The unemployment rate is 7%, and it should start moving lower pretty quickly. And I think we'll be back to full employment, which is an unemployment rate that's somewhere around 5.5% by late 2016. So it should feel palpably better. Not for everybody. I mean, not all ships are going to rise at the same time here. And some groups are going to be left behind. But in general, it should feel better for most people.
We want to pay close attention to that factor, what rises, what gets left behind, what that means. But Heidi Moore, what about the big top-line numbers here? Is that the same kind of array of numbers that you're seeing? Are you on board with that expectation?
I think there are things that we have to be cautious about when looking at the jobs numbers, specifically that the kinds of jobs that we're adding tend to be very low quality, low wage, and we've seen overall wages falling in the rest of the economy. So that's one troubling trend. Mm-hmm. Another troubling trend is that as the job rate, the unemployment rate itself falls, that's largely because people are out of the workforce. That could be because of retirement, or it could be because they're completely discouraged and aren't looking for a job anymore. But right now we're looking at, it's called the labor force participation rate.
Sure.
And that rate is around 62 or 63%, which is the lowest since something like 1982, the Reagan years. So those are what we have to be careful of when we're talking about the employment numbers. But certainly, I think Mark makes a good point that by 2016, we'll have had enough run room for something to improve. The question is whether that will really be this year without any other factors that we're using to help employment, like, for instance, a jobs bill from Congress or infrastructure spending or something happening in the corporate sector. None of that has come through for the past 4 years.
Mark Zandi, roll the tape back for us a little bit here. At the beginning of almost every year for the last several, we've heard a message something like this, and I wonder if listeners have become jaundiced about it. Roll the tape back and tell us what's different this time.
Yeah, you make an excellent point, Tom. We've been waiting for this and anticipating it. I think the key difference is that the economy's, what you might call fundamentals, are in very good shape. American businesses have reduced their cost structures. They're highly profitable. They're very, very competitive globally. Of course, the energy story is a big plus for them. The banking system has done a lot of hard work and has recapitalized. So it now has a big capital cushion in case things go wrong, which it didn't have historically. And households have reduced debt and delevered, and the burden of debt is about as low as it's been in 25, 30 years. So fundamentally, the private economy has come a long way since the recession, and each and every year since the recession has improved. And we've gotten to a point now where I think all the preconditions are in place for a much better economy. The other reason I think this year we'll actually see this improvement is that the fiscal drag on the economy, that is, the tax increases and government spending cuts that have been such a significant weight on economic growth over the past several 3 years, is going to fade. Under current law, if lawmakers do nothing, and I don't think they'll do anything of consequence, the drag on the economy will fade, and that'll be a major plus for growth going into 2014 and 15. So those two things, I think, are what makes the next couple 3 years different from the past couple 3 years.
How do you look over that mountain range of fundamentals? What do you see?
I think with the fundamentals, the issue about the fiscal drag and what's happening in Congress is absolutely right. We should be seeing less of that. Congress finally agreed on some form of a budget, or will very soon. It doesn't mean that we won't have another last-minute crisis, because some Republicans have whispered that we might sometime this month. But for the most part—
Over debt ceiling and all that jazz.
Exactly. The same thing that we've seen three or four times before. Yep. In the past 3 years. And so we might still have that, but it's much less now. I think a lot of people in Congress are starting to understand that it only hurts them politically to hold the company back fiscally and economically. And that's something that the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, has been very clear about, that Congress and its shenanigans have been very harmful to economic growth, and that they've held back economic growth by creating this uncertainty. It's made business owners somewhat nervous. It's made them more reluctant to spend. And since a large number of jobs and growth come from small businesses who are looking to see what's happening in the economy, that hasn't been helpful at all. So the fiscal drag point, I think, is absolutely right. We should be seeing less of that in a just world, and we might be just stepping into a just world because of the elections.
A just world. There's a big concept. There's a very large concept. Do you agree with Mark? Do you anticipate that all of that, I mean, people say the sequester and the fighting in Washington policy and policy battles may have cost a point or a point and a half off of GDP, a huge whack just in 2013. Mm-hmm. You think that may be behind us?
Yeah, well, I think it may be less. Right. I mean, we can never predict. It is an election year, and, you know, some reckless act could always happen, especially when people are up against the wall fighting for their livelihoods. In this case, lawmakers, they might do extreme things to get attention or to please their donors, or, yep, you know, in some other sort of motivation that we can't yet predict. So that could happen. There is that kind of black swan idea. But for the most part, I think after 3 or 4 years of this, we've seen that it's not a very effective way to govern, and it's not a very effective way to run the economy. So I do tend to agree that we'll probably be seeing less of it, even though the GDP whack itself is kind of hard to measure, just because the GDP numbers have been a little up and down, very volatile. You know, we saw really strong growth in the fourth quarter and not so much for the rest of the year. So it's hard to draw a conclusion just from that. But you can see by the fact that we have 12 million people unemployed, that companies are enjoying their highest stock prices since who knows when. The S&P 500 is at record levels.
And up, and what, nearly a third when you count dividends in last year. A huge jump in 2013.
Yes, exactly. And that point about dividends is an excellent one, because they're using a lot of that money to give it back to shareholders or to buy back their own stock instead of deploying it in the economy by hiring people. And so that's really what I'm looking at 2014 to change. If we see the loosening of the corporate purse strings, and if we see the stock market gains influence the rest of the economy finally, then it'll be a good year. But that's really where I think the leverage point is, because we're otherwise not seeing all of the gains at that top of the economy, the corporate top, trickle down into the rest of the economy. And it's a shame, because it's a lot of money that's not being deployed.
I want to dig on into each of those sectors you're talking about and see what may be there, what industries may be engines. But Mark Sandy, what about the idea, the old formula was? You see the GDP bump up, pump up, and, you know, good times roll. Not for everybody. There's always poverty, but very widely. Does that still work in the American economy, Mark?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's taken a long time to kick into gear, and the benefits so far of the better economy have been very narrowly distributed to higher-income, wealthy households. But I do think as we get stronger growth, as unemployment declines, as we get closer to full employment, then wage growth more broadly will begin to pick up and the benefits of the stronger economy will become more widely dispersed. So, yes, I think that's going to happen over the next couple, 3 years. But having said that, I do think we do have a longer-term issue here with regard to the distribution of income and wealth. And some broader trends are in place to suggest that higher-income households are going to continue to do disproportionately well relative to lower and middle-income households. So that trend has been in place now for 25, 30 years, and there's no reason to suspect that that's going to change anytime soon. But for the very near term, for the next couple, 3-4 years, yes, I think the economy is going to improve to the degree that the benefits of this better economy are felt more broadly. Not by everybody. You know, even in the best of times, there are going to be groups that are going to be locked out.
Mark and Heidi, let me just bring us right out of the gate. We've got questions and concerns from listeners about how this really works after all this time. Here's a listener who says on Facebook, our economy now struggles to compete in a global marketplace. We're not the only ones to innovate. There are many elsewhere with an easy reach who will work harder for much less. Are we still stuck in that problem, Mark, when it comes to economic growth and job creation?
No, I don't think so. I actually think American companies are highly competitive. I mean, one of the best measures of international competitiveness is to look at the labor compensation relative to the productivity of that labor force. That's so-called unit labor costs. And in the United States, unit labor costs today are about where they were 10 years ago. But if you go look at the same costs in Europe or in Asia, in the emerging world, China, India, they've risen quite considerably. And in manufacturing, which is very obviously globally competitive, that's where a lot of the competition occurs.
Sure.
U.S. unit labor costs today are where they were 25 years ago. So, no, I think American companies have done a fabulous job of getting their financial houses in order in returning to competitiveness. And I think they're as competitive as they've ever been. And on top of all of that, I think you have to consider the benefits of what's going on in the energy sector and the prospects for very low natural gas prices, electricity prices, which are very, very important for manufacturers going forward. So I think we're poised for much stronger growth in large part because we are very competitive.
What sectors of manufacturing are doing well or are poised to do well, Mark?
Technology, aerospace, machine tools, sophisticated instrumentation, sophisticated materials, of course, agricultural products, construction equipment, you know, even autos, auto parts, you know, really across the board. If you're a manufacturer in the U.S. and you survived the Great Recession, if you got through it, you have to be doing something right. You have to be very, very cost competitive or have a market niche or both. And I think American manufacturers, you know, they're really well poised to do quite well across the board.
How much of that is now, I don't know, robotic or free of mass, you know, employment?
Yeah, no, excellent point. Now, manufacturing is very highly productive, and you don't get the same job gains that you would in other parts of the economy with an increase in production. So we can't look to manufacturing as a major source of jobs going forward. It will be a source of jobs, which is actually a big change from where we've been over the last 25 years mm-hmm. when we've been losing jobs in manufacturing. I think we're going to see job growth in manufacturing, but you make an absolutely excellent point. That's not where the bulk of the jobs are going to come from.
How do you see this realm, foreign competition, manufacturing in particular, and job creation on that front?
I think, you know, the foreign competition issue is a complicated one. I would tend to agree with Mark that U.S. companies are much stronger than we give them credit for, particularly because the growing economies of India and China have their own challenges and have been slowing down significantly, especially in the past year. China, in particular, is struggling under a lot of local government debt. Local governments have been borrowing a lot of money, mm-hmm. and that's been adding to the country's debt load. So you've seen less household spending and less investment. So even though China's growth rate is enormous compared to us, around 7.6%, it's been dropping. And that trend is what you want to watch when you look at economics. Are things dropping or are they rising? And so China's dropping. India similarly had a big currency issue last year and is dealing with that. It also has some internal challenges. For instance, it's such a huge country that it's difficult just to take a train from one city to another. And that affects shipping and making sure that materials get from one place to another. So those countries, even though we might envy their growth right now, are kind of mimicking where the U.S. was in its industrial growth 40 or 50 years ago. And when they settle down and become much more like us, much more established, we'll see their growth slow down as well.
Heidi, Mark looks at manufacturing and says, well, we'll have more employment there than we have had because it's been so bad. But there's still a kind of yes and no quality about whether that's a real job-creating engine. If the economy is going to take off, if it comes with job creation, Mark says, may get us back down to full employment in a couple, 3 years here. First of all, do you agree? And second, where will the jobs come from in this period of growth? What sectors? What industries?
Yeah, well, I'm a little bit more cautious about manufacturing, just in taking a look at the numbers. For 2013, we added something like 4,000 jobs a month in manufacturing. That's pretty low. 4,000 jobs in a country of, 300 million isn't really going to get you very far. And people have been looking towards a manufacturing recovery largely driven by what President Obama wants. He did a whole whistle-stop tour about manufacturing and the middle class a couple of years ago and this year. And so it's important to have more manufacturing jobs. And then the key is, okay, so where are they going to come from? What we've seen is people putting a lot of stock in the housing recovery. And housing, of course, requires construction.
Yeah.
And so some people believe, housing will drive this year in manufacturing. Some people believe it will be autos because the auto sector has been doing really well. Mm-hmm. And other people believe that it might be technology, which requires fewer parts and which, quite frankly, tend to be manufactured more overseas, even though we've had some savvy U.S. companies make a big deal about, building factories here in the U.S., like
yep.
Apple. A lot of that tech stuff really is going to happen overseas, and it's not quite sure we'll be able to grab back the market share we've lost over the past 20 years in making parts here, semiconductor parts or chips or any other thing like that, that really benefits from low labor and robotics, as you pointed out. But the belief is, in 2014, a lot of people really want a manufacturing comeback, and they have very optimistic predictions. Barclays, for instance, predicts that we'll start adding 20,000 jobs a month in 2014 to manufacturing. I mean, remember, we're adding 4,000 now. So to go up to 20,000 is a big boom. So there are some very smart people who do expect a boom. You'll have to watch the housing sector and the auto sector in particular to see if that manifests.
Mark, if you're right, if we're back on track or climbing up on the tracks toward full employment this year, and you say manufacturing, yes and no, as a job creator, yes and no. Where else? What else? Where do you see the jobs coming from?
I think it'll be broad-based. I think Heidi is correct. Housing is going to be a major source of job growth. A lot of construction jobs, transportation jobs, because you have to move materials around, jobs at Home Depot, Lowe's, other home improvement and financial services because of the mortgages that have to be originated, landscaping, cable hookup. I mean, housing runs very deep into the job market, and as we get more homes built, and we will just because of demographics and the low level of construction that exists today, that's going to create a boatload of jobs. And the good news about that is it's everywhere. It's not just in Phoenix or Minneapolis. It's going to be coast to coast. And then beyond that, I think the service side of the economy is going to create a lot of jobs. We, the United States, are very, very competitive producing a range of services. Accounting services, legal services, media, advertising, architectural services, management consulting, financial services. These are things that we've been doing for many, many decades, and we do them very, very well. No one else competes. And the thing that's really important is that the emerging world has, up to this point, been largely buying consumer goods, durables, automobiles, appliances, cell phones, that kind of thing. They've got them now in many of these countries, and now they're going to look for these services, and we provide those. And so that's what we're going to be selling to the rest of the world going forward. Now, to do that, though, we need a highly educated and skilled workforce because these things require a lot of skills and education. So, that's a challenge to us. and something we're going to have to address in lots of different ways. But that's where the jobs are going to be, and that's where the jobs are going to come from. And by the way, they will be very high-paying, high-quality jobs.
If you can snag one of those. Mark, Sandy, Heidi Moore, stand by. Lots of listeners weighing in here. Warren, Ohio. Jeff is on the line. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. Happy New Year, Jeff. What do you see out there?
Oh, thanks. Well, right now I see a huge snowstorm, but
you and a lot of others.
I was sharing that I am the CFO for a site contractor. We are the first guys in on any construction project, doing the mass excavation and the underground utilities.
So you're literally ground level. So what do you see there,
exactly,
Jeff?
Exactly. I see a sort of a split personality to our company. We do traditionally have been involved in commercial construction,
yep,
but in the past year and a half have been very heavily involved in the oil and gas industry,
yep,
because this area of Ohio has the Utica Shale.
Fracking and all the rest.
Exactly. And our company doubled in size last year. Two-thirds of that was from oil and gas.
Okay.
We're actually very slow when it comes to commercial construction. There's not a lot going on. Although, as one of your commenters talked about, we did get a contract to do a road for housing development. But most of our work is now coming in the oil and gas side, and that's where our growth is. So it's a real split in our if we hadn't got involved in that, we'd be having a very, very difficult time.
Hey, Jeff, hold that thought. Stick with us here. Mark, Sandy, that sounds like, in a way, a challenge to what you're saying. I mean, it's great for Jeff's company that they're building a bunch of new energy sites. On the other hand, he doesn't see commercial. I don't know what that means, new malls and new office buildings and all the rest going up. What do you make of that, Mark? If that's not happening, you can't do it just on energy alone.
No, yeah, actually, I think that's where we're going to get a lot of growth. I mean, the level of commercial construction, that it's office buildings, that's hotels, that's warehouses, that's retail malls, that's storage space, has been very depressed. In fact, the level of commercial construction today is about as low as it's ever been relative to the size of the economy. And as a result of that, vacancy rates are coming in many parts of the country. Rents are starting to rise. Prices for these properties are starting to rise very rapidly. These are all the preconditions for much stronger building going forward. And I do anticipate a significant pickup in commercial construction over the next several years. Now, unlike housing, that's going to be more spotty regionally. That really does depend on where you are in the country.
Yep.
So if you're sitting in Texas, or you're sitting in Florida, or you're a contractor in California, I think you'd be seeing different things even at this point in time than you would if you're in Ohio or New York.
But why is that? I mean, Jeff's sitting on the Utica Shale. They've got a lot of energy business going. Not everybody likes it, but it's booming. Why wouldn't that already be reflected in laying down foundations for commercial construction?
Well, because the thing that drives commercial construction would be you need job growth, a lot of job growth. You need business travelers. You need a lot of movement of goods and services. And, you know, the Northeast and industrial Midwest have fared more poorly in that regard. Businesses are expanding and growing more rapidly in other parts of the country, and that's where you're going to see the commercial construction. Now, the energy boom is very similar to the manufacturing boom, is not very job intensive, right? I mean, this is a highly productive kind of activity. It creates jobs, no doubt. And
right,
in fact, in those parts of the country, we're seeing more jobs. But it's not going to create the kind of job growth that the other service sides of the businesses will create.
You get the pipe down and let it run.
And those are the service jobs that, is a fodder for office space demand, for retail space, for hotels, that kind of thing. So that's why you're not going to see the same kind of commercial construction in places that are juiced by the energy boom. The energy boom is great, and it has a long way to run, but that's not going to be the fodder for a lot of commercial construction.
Jeff, good luck in Warren, Ohio. Give us a call mid-year and tell us how it's going. Jim in Dedham, Massachusetts. Jim, thanks for calling. Happy New Year. What do you see?
And a happy new year. I'm seeing snow, and I have a question in particular for Mr. Sandy, because I'm hearing him say that there's not going to be big job growth out of manufacturing or energy, and he's identified construction as where the job growth is primarily going to be located.
Yep.
And I'm sure
and services, yep.
and services. Okay, fair enough. I want to focus on the construction because I haven't heard anything about demand. And in particular, Mr. Sandy, my question is, how do you know that there is a body of people who want to buy the home, have the money for the down payment, and are likely to qualify for a mortgage under the more stringent requirements?
Yeah, really good points. Well, let me just give you a couple of numbers. I mean, the current level, let's just stick to housing. Yep. Housing construction is about 900,000 units. So that's how much, that's the number of
nationally per year.
Mm-hmm. Nationally per 900,000. Mm-hmm. In a typical economy, not even a really good one, just a normal economy, we should be producing 1.7 million homes. And much of that is just household formation. I mean, that's just the population growth that occurs in the economy, looking at age, ethnic distribution of the population. And the level of household formation has been well above the level of construction now for 5 or 6 years. And the result is that we've blown through a lot of vacant housing units. There are no excess housing vacant units in most parts of the country. In some parts of the country, we're now seeing a shortage of housing. Texas, a really excellent case in point. And so just the simple demographics argue strongly that we're going to need a lot more housing units going forward. Now, what kind of housing units? You know, that will be different going forward than has been the case in the past. We're going to be building a lot more multifamily units than we have single-family units for some obvious reasons. But nonetheless, we're going to be building a lot more homes. Let me just give you another couple of rules of thumb. Every single-family home we put up creates 4 jobs over a period of a year. You know, those are the jobs that I mentioned earlier. Yep. Every multifamily unit that goes up produces 2 jobs. So you need to just do a little bit of arithmetic. That's a boatload of jobs in lots of different parts of the country over the next several years. I'm not saying construction in housing is going to be a major source of long-term job creation. All I'm saying is that over the next several years, it's going to be the key source of job creation.
Heidi, we've got a minute before the break here. How do you see the demand side of this? I mean, I'm looking at a story just out yesterday, sales booming for Lamborghinis and Porsches and Bentleys and Rolls Royce and Jaguar, but that's high-end stuff. What about demand broadly and its role in a comeback if we've got one brewing?
Well, you know, there's probably a reason those Lamborghinis are for sale. It's because a lot of those people are buying up housing stock. One of the things we've seen in housing over the past year is that a lot of it has gone to deep-pocketed investors who are hoping to rent it out later. And so for the rest of us, that's meant that home prices are rising because you've seen the big money come in and pay more than they have to. And you've also seen the inventory really low. And of course, we know from simple supply and demand, when inventory is low, prices rise. The problem with that is unless you have a ton of money, you're probably not going to be able to buy a house because credit is still constrained. Banks aren't lending for mortgages as much as they used to, although they are loosening that a little bit. So it's kind of a little bit challenged if you're a regular homeowner in the housing market, much better than it was a year ago, 2 years ago, and certainly 5 years ago. But it's still not in a great position where people can go out and feel that sense of mobility. And to an extent, that's what's been holding the labor market back, because if you can't sell your house, if you can't move, mm-hmm. then you're probably not going to go somewhere else for a new job.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the economy in 2014, the new year, asking, does it finally take off? And what does that now mean? Boy, we got a lot of response here. Heidi, Sarah asks us, she says, is GDP still a good indicator of national wealth when distribution of that wealth, I guess, is so insanely skewed? And here's Kenny asking on Facebook. He says, the philosophies that govern our economy are not designed to benefit anyone but the wealthiest people. It's so discouraging to hear your guest excuse an ideology that's not worked for regular workers for more than 30 years. People are kind of sick of hearing about GDP's up, but, you know, it doesn't get spread around and people, you know, a whole lot of people don't make progress, Heidi.
Yeah, you know, I would certainly not say that I'm excusing it. And if anything, I believe that inequality is one of the major issues of 2014. And it's a matter of making sure that the people who actually have any power over affecting inequality, that is CEOs and Congress, do something about it. And so, you know, is GDP a good measure of wealth? I would say that if you're looking at any economic statistic, you should be incredibly wary. Those numbers are not as definite and sure as you might think they are. That extends to unemployment numbers, housing numbers, and GDP. GDP tends to measure the higher parts of the economy, high finance, you know, things like trade. You know, to the extent that it measures what's going on with us, it only measures how much we're spending. So it's not really looking at the health of your family. It's looking at how much you're deploying in stores, and it's assuming that the economy is healthy based on that.
Well, though, if you're spending, something's going. Something's going, right? You've got resources from somewhere.
Well, it might be credit. And for a long time, for the past 4 years, that's what it's been. People have been borrowing to pay off their bills or, you know, to do their shopping. And even though, you know, household debt has been kind of down since the height, it's been steadily rising again. And so that's one thing to watch. People will spend money they don't have. I mean, we should not assume that, you know, everyone's working on a cash or a debit card system, because that's long gone. So GDP doesn't really take into account those factors. I think what happens is, with economic statistics, because there are so many ways to interpret them, and it's almost a philosophical argument, it depends on what your biases are going in as to whether they're good or not. For instance, the White House, which has a lot invested in making the economy look good under President Obama, has been sending out a lot of emails saying the economy is improving, things are so much better, we've added all of these jobs. And you can see things in that way. It's not really a comfort if you're one of the 12 million people who are unemployed, or one of the people who have a part-time job because no one will hire you for more than 4 hours at minimum wage, or if you're one of the 10 million homeowners whose house is worth less than you paid for it. That is small comfort for people to be lecturing you about how great the economy is when you're not experiencing it. And I think that there has been a huge reality gap in Washington particularly, but also in corporate suites, about what the influences of those higher levels of economic decision-making have on regular people. And I would generally agree that the regular people aspect of it has been entirely dropped. I mean, in a normal and a rational world, you would have seen a major jobs bill coming through Congress sometime after 2009. You know, they had that useless stimulus omnibus that I don't want to call it useless, but it wasn't really effective. It was a lot of pork barrel waste. And we haven't seen a jobs bill. We haven't seen infrastructure spending. And that's an indication that Congress, and to some extent the White House, as well as corporate suites, don't really see unemployment as a problem they have to do something about. For a long time, they've left that to the Federal Reserve, and it's only recently that the Federal Reserve has kind of thrown off that yoke, just last month, and said, we're not going to do everything. Congress really does have to step in, because they're making this harder for everybody.
There's a lot to look at there. Mark Zandi, I want to bring the big issue to you, but let me get a caller here first from New York. Tivoli, New York. D is calling. Hi, D. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much. Oh. I just wanted to talk about the false numbers that are involved in the fracking industry. What we're finding when we really crunch the numbers is that many of those workers are coming into small towns in Pennsylvania and Ohio, and then infrastructure spending rises and rents rise, and people swoop in and raise the rents and raise the infrastructure costs and raise the numbers in terms of how employment looks. And then many of those folks go back home to Texas and to West Virginia, where drilling started. And so actually that industry is very much like the film industry, in that people come in, they work for a time. Unlike the film industry, they leave that environment much worse off than when it was in the pre-fracking days. And there's new infrastructure that nobody needs, and then they're off.
Blush you're seeing there, Dee. Mark Zandi, let me put that report from the field to you. What do you think?
Well, you know, fracking is not a slam dunk positive, and I think the caller does point out there are negatives. I mean, the environmental issues are quite significant. But I do think what's going on in the energy sector broadly is very positive, in that it has significantly reduced energy costs, particularly the cost of natural gas, and by extension, the cost of electricity. So these are very obviously important inputs into manufacturing. It's a key cost of a living for many, many households. So this is a very significant plus for our economy. But nonetheless, it's not costless. There are downsides to it, and we have to be very cognizant of that. And And I think it's important that policymakers take that into consideration when they consider regulation and taxation of the fracking and energy sector more broadly.
And what about the big structural issue here? Listeners complaining GDP doesn't capture reality for a lot of people and may not be an accurate presentation of what our economy, of its real health across the whole population or a big portion of it, Mark.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, GDP is just one number, and you can't encapsulate what's going on in our economy with just one number. And, you know, I do think our most significant long-term problem is the distribution of income and wealth. It has become more skewed. I'll just give you, you know, a sense of that. I mean, the folks that are in the top 20% of the income distribution, you know, these are the highest 20%
yep.
in the population, they account for 60% of the spending. The top 5% account for 35% of the spending. You know, that's just not healthy, I think, longer run. And so we do need to address it. Let me say two quick things about that, though. First, I think these trends, while they're still in place and will remain in place, will become less pressing going forward. That, you know, one of the reasons for this skewing of the distribution of income wealth has been globalization and the fact that lower income workers in the U.S. have been competing against low wage workers in the emerging world. That's changing because the costs in the emerging world are rising, and so we're on a much more level playing field. And so that force that's been skewing the distribution of income wealth will become a little less pressing going forward. But having said that, the second thing I'll say is, We as a nation need to address this, and the best way to address this is by raising the skill level, the educational attainment of everyone. And so we need to invest a lot more in education, in training, in skills. You know, there's unemployed people that are unemployed for long periods of time. They're just not going to get back into the workforce unless they get new skills. We have to get better about figuring out how to raise their skill and educational attainment levels so they can get back into the workforce.
Unless we do that, this
is going to be a problem we're not going to be able to address.
When you say inequality is a problem, do you mean it's a moral problem or an economic problem?
That's a great question. You know, economists like me feel uncomfortable addressing the moral question. I mean, that goes into the realm of politics. But I do think we're getting to the point where it's an economic one, that if the distribution of income and wealth is so skewed, I think it diminishes our ability to grow. I mean, if the top 20% account for 60% of the spending, then, you know, that means the bottom 80% are not going to be able to continue to spend. You know, you remember the old story about Henry Ford and the Model T. Mm. You know, he made a decision that he was going to pay his workers more than he had to because he felt that if he didn't do that, they wouldn't be able to purchase the Model T, and he wouldn't produce as many. So, you know, that's kind of the metaphor I think we need to start thinking about in the context of the current skewing of distribution of income and wealth. We're getting to that point where this is an issue for economic growth, not just the distribution of who gets the benefits of economic growth.
Heidi, skills and education, I mean, no one can argue with that. We absolutely have to have that in this global economy. Does that do it when you get an economy that starts to get wrapped around so much spending by a small portion of the population? Does skills fix it?
Well, skills help kind of raise more boats. It's exactly as Mark said. You cannot have a full-on economic recovery if only 10 to 20% of the population is actually experiencing anything financially beneficial. It just can't happen. You can't do it with 80% of the population not participating in economic growth. And so we do have to address what is happening with what we might call everybody else. For some people, that is going to be skills retraining. Skills retraining is very expensive. You know, it's almost like schooling, and it takes some time, and it requires the buy-in of corporations. And so one of the complications with it is that it would require probably the government to subsidize what corporations are doing or to work with the government. Now, we've seen some corporations do that. JP Morgan, for instance, just made an investment in skills retraining and is working, I believe, to some extent with the government on that. And so, you know, it can happen, but it also has to happen, and I don't think that has been really accepted across corporate America. If you talk to companies like Boeing and, you know, other companies that require specialized skills, they complain constantly of not finding people who they can hire. And, you know, skills retraining is one obvious way to close that gap. Another way that companies close that gap is by going to, you know, companies or countries like India and looking for highly skilled workers who, ironically, have had skills retraining in their own countries. And so we get the benefit of the training that they've gotten in China or in India and bring them here. We could do that a lot more evenly if we also worked on American workers the way that in India and in China, workers are constantly kept up to date on new skills. But, you know, right now it's kind of up and out, you know, and we're also seeing a huge retirement wave of baby boomers who, having lost their jobs, are saying maybe it's just time to leave the workforce.
And take, so those and are the take problems. Their skills with them, potentially. Ryan in Franklin, Tennessee. Ryan, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hello. One of the things that I've heard no mention of is the impact of Obamacare. We hear that it's going to be a positive to the economy. We hear it's going to be a negative to the economy. And I'd like to hear your folks' opinion on it.
Great question. Very timely. Of course, it's rolling out for real right now. Mark Zandi, what about the net impact of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare?
You know, I don't think it has any net macroeconomic impact. There are negatives. There are positives. The biggest negatives, I think, are occurring right now as we adjust to the big changes that are in the healthcare law. And so it's, you know, creating a lot of angst and pain among business people, particularly smaller businesses and households who have to adjust to all of this. But there are benefits. And I think net-net, when it all plays out and we look back 5 years from now, I don't think it's going to have any macroeconomic consequence. You know, for example, I do a lot of forecasting. I have not changed my outlook for the economy as a result of Obamacare, and I don't think any other macroeconomic forecasters have done that either.
Well, to come to that conclusion, does it come from a perspective that it's going to be successful so it won't have a problem, or it's not going to have much impact one way or another? Somehow, I mean, what are your presumptions in that no net macroeconomic impact outlook?
Well, it's certainly that it's not going to be a disaster, that it doesn't completely fall apart, that it's going to be roughly paid for. That is, the key objective of Obamacare. There are many objectives, but the key objective is to insure the uninsured, and that's costly. It doesn't come without a cost, but the key working assumption here is that we are going to insure the uninsured and roughly pay for it. And I think we're on track for that. One, if it's not a disaster, and two, if it's roughly paid for, those are the two key assumptions to come to the conclusion that it's not going to have an impact, a broad impact on jobs, on unemployment, on GDP, those things that we look at when we try to gauge how the economy is doing in a broad sense.
Janet Yellen coming in as head of the Federal Reserve Bank, Ben Bernanke, of course, out. He says we're going to cut back on the stimulus, quantitative easing. She seems on board with that. So the government's getting out of the stimulus business on that front. What impact of that, Mark? Are we off? Are we weaned off of that now? Or getting there? Going there?
No, we got a ways to go. I mean, in my mind, this is the key near term threat to my optimism. I mean, for this to work out as I expect, the Federal Reserve is going to have to manage the increase in interest rates. That is the ending the quantitative easing program you mentioned, in a way that's consistent with the improvement in the job market. So if interest rates rise, if mortgage rates rise. But they rise in a way that's consistent with the decline in unemployment, increase in jobs, then we're golden. We're good. It's all going to work out as I anticipate. But that's a tricky thing to get exactly right. You know, we're in uncharted territory. We've never been down this path. So, you know, this is we're doing this on the fly. So it may not work as well as I'm anticipating. And that's the key, in my mind, the key reason for nervousness about how things go in 2014. I mean, if the Fed doesn't manage long-term rates consistent with the improvement in job market, say they jump and mortgage rates go from 4.5% today where they are to 5% or 5.5% in a few months, then the housing market isn't going to turn like I expected, and we're not going to get the jobs as I expected. So this is really very, very important, and it's the key threat to any optimism about 2014.
But the outlook there from Mark Zandi, back to full employment by what year was that, Mark?
Tom, I said I'll make an intrepid forecast for
okay.
you. Election Day 2016, back to full employment.
Okay. That would be some act of recovery and maybe...
I'm on the record.
You're on the record. Mark Zandi, Chief Economist from Moody's Analytics. A good 2014 to you, sir, and thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Heidi Moore, U.S. Finance and Economics Editor for The Guardian. Heidi, what do you think? Full employment, Election Day 2016?
I'll go with that, but I remain skeptical. Depends on what Congress does. If they get their act together, then sure, why not?
Oh, that seems to be a big if lately, but we'll be watching. Heidi, thank you very much for joining at the beginning of this new year. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you. Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us, and a happy 2014 to everybody. You can join the conversation, continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Be first to find out tomorrow's topics and guests at our Facebook page. Hit that like button. You'll get alerts on upcoming shows right there in your news feed. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.